Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrio.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school. Hey, everybody. Hope that you have a great week. We're excited to bring you an episode today. Sebastian, what is your favorite actor?
Who is my favorite actor? My grammar is suffering today. And actor is the right word for like male and female now, right?
So yeah, that's like what I meant.
I think so.
I mean, like any person that acts.
Acting person. Yes.
Yeah, acting person.
Good question. But I have to think about it.
So we can pass it off to Joe.
Joe, do you have an answer?
I do. Does it have to be on screen or does it?
Anywhere.
Okay. So I love voice actors. I love cartoons. So my favorite voice actor of all time is Keith David. So if you grew up in the 90s, if you remember Goliath from Gargoyles.
Oh, nice.
He's been the voice of that. But he's also done some on-screen work. I have a thing for voice actors because I love cartoons.
Wow, yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I like that answer. Alex, you already have one in mind?
So my favorite actor for a while there, my wife would make fun of me about this. I just liked the string of movies Matthew McConaughey was in.
Because
when he shifted out of those rom-coms, he was just in some really good movies there for a while. Yeah. And now she just mocks me.
John Grisham, like, I'm going to kill you and hunt you. But
no,
also,
like Dallas Buyers Club and Mud. Yeah. And that Lincoln Lawyer movie was pretty good. But like,
yeah. So, okay. I probably need like a ton of time to think about it. Think just people that came to mind are Natalie Portman. And maybe she sucks, but I don't know why I like her. And I feel like, I guess because she's kind of like,
it's a solid endorsement,
right? Intellectual. And she,
you just like her because she went to Harvard, right? That's what you like.
Yeah, but okay. So maybe this is why I like her. Maybe this is the reason why I like her, because I like watch all the extra whatever things from the V from a Vendetta DVD. And in that, I appreciated how much I feel like thought she put into the role. And maybe that's why I have this seed in my head that I like her. And then, I don't know, Daniel Day-Lewis is the other person that comes to my head. Mm-hmm. I feel like every time I see him, I'm like, that's great. It's badass. I like Joe's answer, voice actor. That seems kind of fun.
So as you have heard, our special guest today is Joe Benitez. Joe's an assistant professor in the Department of Health Management and Policy. His research focuses primarily on the impact of public policy changes on access to care, medically underserved populations, and the role of healthcare in the safety net and Medicaid programs. Thank you very much for being here with us today, Joe. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I feel great, feeling a little bit better these days, and honored to be here. So thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, thank you. We are honored to have you. And now, in addition to learning about your favorite voice actor, could you tell us another fun fact about yourself?
In addition to cartoons, which I just mentioned, I also watch anime.
Watch a lot of anime. Nice.
I also read manga.
Where did you get your mangas from online?
So mostly through a Shonen Jump app. There's an app.
Oh, so they're digital. They're not physical.
Yeah. So digital. Yeah. Like I have small children, and it's hard to keep things clean with small children around, as I imagine, Alex. You'll find out soon. And it's kind of easy. I can read them on the go whenever, like, I'm in between like meetings or in my office.
Yeah. What is the one that you're reading right now?
Tokyo Revengers. Ashton Kutcher's The Butterfly Effect meets Middle School Gang Warfare.
I love
need
that.
No more tagline. That sounds amazing.
It's like so hilariously, like, it's a good, probably good summary, but also like, what?
Before we dive into today's topic, we'd love to hear a little bit about your work. Is there a paper or anything else that you want to promote?
Sure. Broadly speaking, I study Medicaid policy, but I'm mainly interested in how Medicaid is used as a safety net, that it can help people stay afloat while they're experiencing some hard times when they get separated from private health insurance coverage. So most people in this country get their insurance through their employer. So when you don't have an employer, what are you to do? So I'm interested in how Medicaid helps to fill that gap for people while they're looking for a job. I'm in the second year of a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation grant to actually study this.
Congratulations.
Thank you. The COVID crisis is one, it's highlighted a lot of the underlying disparities that already exist in the in inequalities that exist in the US, but it's also created an opportunity for people to understand what policy levers can be used to address inequities, health disparities, and provide broader stability. So that's kind of where I'm at now in terms of my research.
That's great. And I do like that framing about thinking of Medicaid as like a financial safety net. I think people are surprised when sometimes it's framed as like this financial instrument, so to speak, rather than like access to healthcare. And both things are happening.
Totally.
Right? But right. I really like that framing you gave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we know that just health insurance broadly is going to provide some income effects. It's going to allow people to purchase healthcare that they need. But say in policy circles, people might think of Medicaid as an entitlement program. What we know less about is the extent that it is a safety net program where it has this specific income effect when it becomes your substitute source of health insurance coverage.
A segment that we've been doing for a while now is talking about workflow. And we were just hoping if you could walk us through your day-to-day, like how is it that you sort of get it all done? What do you do when you wake up? How do you prioritize which projects to work on? Particularly, you're pre-tenure and you have a large number of projects going on.
Don't stress him out.
I just it's clear that you're doing a lot. So you obviously, you have some way of organizing it all.
Okay. So, we got to think about my pre-COVID workflow and my post-COVID workflow, but I think my post-COVID workflow is forcing me to streamline a lot of things. And long story short, I'm still trying to figure out what my post-COVID workflow is.
You'll figure out once the pandemic is over, which is never. So
yeah. Generally speaking, I start my day with, I wake up.
It's a good start.
It's always a good start to open your eyes. I get myself oriented, and I actually want to browse through econ and health policy Twitter. Mainly just so I can kind of like get like a quick update of.
Right. Is there any emergency thing that I need to know or something like that?
It's actually a really efficient way to get new facts, because we all have, I think in another one of your episodes, you said like how much time you can just spend responding to emails and trying to read emails. And that is very taxing. It can be draining. But sometimes it's really easy to just, open your phone and thumb through a few tweets, and you might come across an article that you might not have otherwise seen. Yep. Or if it's a new report from, say, like a federal agency or Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for example, or maybe even Kaiser Foundation, you might see something that you might not have gotten to if you relied primarily on your inbox. So I think it's actually helpful when the broader research community is circulating what they're seeing as important information that I might have to, fight through a few other emails to get to.
So you start with Twitter. Is that today? I like this day. My advisor was on here recently. He said he started with basketball. So I agree with both of these workflows.
Let's see. I generally say mostly football and basketball, usually for the weekend and the evening.
Productive first thing in the morning.
Yeah, it doesn't take as much mental power when I have to divide that between, a four-year-old and a two-year-old. So those are the competing priorities. Then after that, you know, then I get myself ready for the day, help to get my children ready for the day. And me and my spouse, we split duties so that everybody is able to get ready and we can all.
So that the NGO is up and running.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yes. We are up and go. Everybody has their assigned duties and we go. Sometimes to varying success because children are, you know, very variable.
they're not great employees of the NGO.
You know, not the best. You know, like they can improve. They can improve.
You know, like, you have quarterly meetings with your children.
Yeah, they need to have weekly performance reviews.
Okay, so then you're done with the family, and then you, family, I'm assuming, get to work.
You know, and I'm trying to make it more intentional to just take some time to like read things broadly and to give broader context, because it's so easy to get bogged down in coding. I could spend anywhere from a couple hours, you know, to way more than a couple hours just figuring out code, which, you know, we've all been there and trying to figure out, you know, why something's not working. And then we have to spend some time just Googling, you know, how to use a particular command. Mm-hmm. What am I missing?
Reshape.
Now I'm learning to allocate certain days of the week to certain things. So Tuesdays, I generally have a lot of meetings. I meet with students on Tuesdays. I currently have an independent study student, which so far has been so good. So it's almost like, even though I'm not teaching the semester, I treat it like a teaching slash meeting day. My daily workflow is, I try to give myself more flexibility, but I try to give myself certain tasks for the week that I would like to accomplish.
So it's kind of like weekly to-do list that you assign and sprinkle throughout the week, depending on meetings and stuff like that. And
exactly.
When do you know what you're going to be working on the day? Like, do you take a time to decide the day off or the night before or something different than that?
Usually I try to start off at the beginning of the week.
Okay.
If I'm up to it Sunday night, generally speaking, Monday mornings, and I try to figure out what I want to work on, what I want to accomplish in the week. So like just moving things forward by inches or so. One of the things that the pandemic has made me do is give me a lot more time to be forgiving about my time and getting things done and
totally
trying to make progress, but also trying to give things the proper attention to get them right.
Mm-hmm.
And to an extent, that's been helpful in helping me streamline my thinking.
Mm-hmm. Are you the kind of person that has or likes to have multiple projects at the same time, or you kind of like working on one or two? Like what kind of researcher are you in that way?
I think by nature being in a school of public health, you're always going to have multiple projects.
That's important.
And you'll always be playing different roles on certain projects where it may not be your primary interest, but you have like a supporting role on another project. For example, I don't particularly study diabetes, but I'm part of a diabetes project where it's among the Medicaid population, and I bring my understanding about how Medicaid works, particularly within the state, versus projects where I'm leading. Some of them may be solo, or some may be projects I'm working with people at other places. I try to prioritize based on some deadlines, which some are some are internal deadlines, some are external. So like for funded work, a lot of times there'll be deadlines such as reviews, such as, you know, so like if you're receiving a grant through an outside agency, then you might have to provide bi-monthly or even quarterly updates of how the grant is progressing along.
That makes sense. And you said you have some solo projects. Like what share of your projects are solo?
I generally have maybe like one or two that are solo, but they're kind of like solo initially.
And, I see. And then
as I get comfortable enough, okay, here's a good place where not necessarily like I'm waving my hands, I need help, but
right,
here's where I think
other people's contribution,
someone else's contribution would be really valuable for this paper and give some insights that I may not have, or especially something that I've not thought about.
Thank you for sharing your workflow. Great place to pause and shift to talk about the topic of the day. So today we want to talk about how to navigate working in departments that maybe are not directly tied to your own educational discipline. So maybe as an example, many economists end up working in a broad set of fields. This is also true for sociologists and maybe in political science, where you can work in different departments like public health, public policy, business school, ag schools, etc. So today we want to learn a little bit about how does the perspective of Joe and how he has navigated that through that experience. So maybe we can start and Jujo, walk us through a summary of you finishing up your PhD and go through the market and what was kind of like that first and then second job and kind of like setting up the context of that transition.
Got it. Okay. So I finished my PhD in 2015 from the University of Illinois, Chicago, and I was actually a health policy PhD. Okay. Although my content area was in health economics, so I ended up taking the econometric sequence out of the econ department, as well as health and labor out of the econ department.
Can I ask you a quick clarification question?
Yeah.
What do you think is the main difference in a PhD in health policy like you did and a PhD in economics of somebody who's focusing on health?
At baseline, there's different training around institutional knowledge. So for example, in a health policy PhD, you would get broader exposure to healthcare organizations, even understanding just how the healthcare delivery works, where you learn these things you would learn these things in an econ PhD, but I think it's more learned on the back end as opposed to
through your own kind of learning rather than a class or something that is set up for you to learn that. Okay.
Right. So I actually got my econ training closer to the back end of my PhD. And I hadn't actually had my first econ class ever until I actually got there. And when I realized I liked it, had I had the exposure earlier in life, I learned that I really appreciate and enjoy labor. I like that it's, very much about people and understanding how people interact with the world and so on. But I think one of the biggest things is health policy PhDs, the emphasis on training to be health services researchers, health policy researchers, generally speaking, in similar types of departments, could also be in medical schools or even in, say, think tank organizations, could be like, say, Urban, Mathematica, places like these. Whereas the econ PhD, it's generally the modal expectation is to go into an econ department.
Yep.
I think that's broadly true in my experience. I remember you and I, we might've been at Ash Econ or maybe APAM. I don't remember, Joe, but we were having a conversation once where we were sort of talking about this exact thing where both Sebastian, myself and Joe are all not in economics departments. Right. And we were just talking about like our students that we're training when they go on the market, like, is there a penalty to getting into an econ department or vice versa, like getting into a health services research place based off of where you did your own training? And it was, I think it's probably true, right? That like discipline wants their own discipline.
Right.
And the expectations are generally different. Coming out on the market, I didn't apply to any jobs in econ departments. So it's I knew where I fit. I was comfortable. So I applied to largely job in places like where I'm at now.
So I think it's nice to think about these students who are going into these different types of departments. What are sort of the different expectations that different departments have of their faculty, right? So like, as you said, you only sort of applied to certain types of places. Is that because certain things are different across these different places for an economist? And if so, how is that?
Yeah, and I guess one thing, I wasn't sure how competitive I would actually be for an econ job, not having been a classically trained economist, and I just know that there's a lot of the list of econ classes I would be able to teach is relatively short, as opposed to the list of classes I cannot teach is comparatively long. Vice versa, the other case for a health policy department or school of public health. Some of the main differences in expectations, and I think these are kind of true for the field as a whole, in health policy, health service research, you're broadly recognized by your body of work. Whereas we can largely say for economists, there's a general emphasis on having good identification strategies and writing causal papers. It's not the case for being successful in a public health setting.
Mm-hmm. Can I push for some clarification there?
Sure.
I just want to try to understand that framing. So I think broadly that's like, I get this idea of the body of work being like a large number of papers, each mm-hmm. that's sort of a snippet of a piece of a larger conversation. So like a modal health service researcher might have like 10 articles, whereas like an economist who studies the same topic maybe might have one or two articles.
Correct.
Is this sort of what you mean by like identification? Be like, we sort of like compress all that stuff into like a couple tables, and then we have like, we really highlight the one, maybe you'd have one paper that has like some IV or something.
Yeah.
And like that's like the focal point of the econ paper. Is that a fair characterization there?
Well, okay. So I can even work backwards. So for going up for tenure in an econ department, depending on where you are, I think, and you guys, please correct me. I know you're not in econ departments, but you're very much economists. So like allegedly. You can go.
I don't have my card yet.
Yeah. So like if you go up with like 6 to 7, then that seems pretty competitive. Whereas for public health schools, in a lot of places, you're generally expected to have at least 20. For epidemiology departments, might be a little bit more.
Wow.
I know of one place now, their tenure process is much longer, so over a 10-year period, but I think supposed to go up with maybe 60 or so papers.
That is terrifying.
Yeah.
So, okay, this is interesting about like number of papers in different fields. Within these fields, is there any trade-offs about quantity and what the perceived rank of the journal is? So like, if you see a profile that has 5 New England Journal of Medicine versus another profile that has like 20 and I don't know, you name the journal X, like, is there still that like trade-off between ranking of or perceived ranking of the journal, let's say, and quantity, or not necessarily? It's like, well, we don't care if you have 5 New England Journal of Medicines, you still just have 5 type of deal.
It's hard to get a definitive answer, but it's not like pure bean counting, but there's not like a whole lot of weighting towards like, okay, this person has 10 papers in New England Journal of Medicine, Health Affairs. Mm-hmm. Maybe a journal of health economics, and then this person has, you know, 10 papers, but they're in, say, you know, some other journals, right?
Right.
I see. It's kind of tough to have these conversations because we're talking about things outside of our own disciplines. But it is my understanding that in many places, grants are required for tenure, and perhaps certain types of grants. So like, it could be in certain schools of public health, like, you need an R01 from the NIH to get tenure. Whereas in other places, like having applied for them is nice, but it has no bearing whatsoever at all on your tenure decision.
Right. And for a lot of the public health schools and across the board, so not just health policy departments, but generally speaking, an R01 or R01 type funding is an expectation for tenure and promotion. Mm. And it doesn't have to be like, say, just from NIH. Granted, for some departments, NIH funding might be treated as the gold standard.
Just to clarify that, I think it's an important point. So you may receive like 2 pots of money. They're both called R01. They're both the same money, but because it comes with the NIH, it is valued more than if it were not coming from NIH. Is that
some departments are like that? Yeah,
wow, that's interesting.
Yes, but that is true.
Oh, wow. I think broadly, right? It's like NIH, NIA, NSF, like any of the national places are given
more prestigious.
They're more prestigious. Yeah. I think they affect like the US News and World Rankings, but I'm not, I know I just said that on a podcast, but like, don't quote me on that.
I guess I just thought they were more competitive maybe. And that's why
I haven't thought about that at all, but like that could be part of it. Cause I do know they do factor into the rankings.
So interesting.
Alex is right.
Oh, wow.
So it doesn't just have to be say federal. So like, as we're talking NIA, NIH, if it comes from, say, the American Cancer Society or Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, any maybe more clinically oriented society, like say if the American Diabetes Association gave out multi-year funding, and that's what most places will call it. They'll refer to it as multi-year funding that covers a substantial portion of your salary.
So I hear that, right, in some of these places that are what some people know them as like self-money positions, where you kind of have to write a lot of grants and bring some money to raise your own salary. And then you also talk about like having a number of publications. So is it the case that departments want usually both or usually focus on one? Like, could I bring a lot of money to the department, not have a lot of pubs? And is that okay? Or no, you have to bring a lot of money and you have to have a lot of pubs.
Yeah, so like it's generally, so kind of what makes you competitive for getting the funding is that you would generally have a lot of.
Okay, so they're like correlated.
Yeah, exactly. So they're positively related. But you know, it's definitely some reverse causality there. I guess, and then there's the trade-offs there. So kind of like there's the expectation that you publish more, that you compete for external funding to cover some of your salary, but you also generally teach less. My current teaching load, I teach one class a year.
Wow. So that's a huge difference, right? Between what some people in regular academia, I don't know if the regular academia started where, but like more traditional, right, departments.
As we're talking about this, as if there's only three of them, but of course there's like a continuum of these types of schools. There's like the econ department. Then there's the School of Public Health kind of on the other end of the spectrum, where it's the soft money and the teaching. And then I think there's a lot of places in between, right?
Yeah.
There's like a differing teaching load with like a kind of differential grant expectation.
Right. Yeah. And to that question about like the continuum or the spectrum, probably if you're in a med school. So like there are economists who are in medical schools, who some medical schools may be 100% soft or 85% soft, where you're expected to cover 85% of your salary in external funding. I think on average, 40 to 50% in external funding is at least what I'm aware of, you know, like pretty standard across the board. Although there are some public health schools that are what we would think of as hard money, where there aren't these funding expectations.
But then you do more teaching.
Right. So you would teach like what you guys are used to, so which would be a 2-2 load.
So I think this is important to just like, let me highlight or summarize, which is if you're going to or started thinking about a position with self-money, usually that should come with less teaching load, because essentially you're using the grant money to buy yourself out of research, if you want to think about it like that, versus on the other extreme where you're teaching a lot and you'd have to get any grants, really you're justifying your salary through the teaching, which is how you get tuition and on. And so I think that's a good way to, and at least how I have understand the trade-offs, which makes me ask a question for you, Joe. Is there a profile of a junior scholar that you would recommend for certain schools and not for the others? And the kind of answers I'm thinking about is, you could say like, oh, actually, if you don't really enjoy teaching, maybe an environment where there's low teaching load could be much more helpful, but maybe that's not really important because it doesn't matter how much you like teaching. Really, the important thing is to get grants. And so that should be like the primary skill. So like, is there any characteristics about junior scholar that you would think like this, if you like this, come here. If you don't like this, definitely don't do this kind of like work in this type of departments.
So teaching is not to say that it's not valued. Generally, most schools of public health have fewer undergrads, if they have any undergrads at all. Mm-hmm. So most of our teaching comes from master students and generally smaller PhD programs. We now have our first cohort in our PhD program, and let's say we have six students, but for an econ program, you might have six students within a field. So like, okay, here's the six health econ leaning students or six that declare health as their field. And then you might have, say, 10 that are focusing on labor and public, so to speak. So lower need for teaching in terms of like quantity of courses. But I still think like even when we do teach the smaller number of courses, there's still an emphasis on quality teaching as well. So not to say you can't get tenure and be a horrible teacher, even if you're just bringing in grants money, there's still some emphasis on providing quality teaching.
So, and maybe going back to that question, like how do you know if this is the right fit for you?
Sometimes it comes down to like what different place, like ideally if you have multiple offers, you're able to choose which one you think is a better match for you. I think if you are ambitious and enterprising about your research ideas, and if you actually get some excitement out of, like, especially if you're a really good grant writer and have pretty innovative ideas, then it can, well, ideas that you that can be funded. And that's generally something I struggle with in my own. But if you are comfortable with the idea of competing for grant monies, then being in a public health school could also be attractive options for you.
Right.
But there's also pharmacy schools and med schools.
One question: how do you know that you're a good grant writer? Because to me, it seems like chicken or the egg. Like, well, you're a good grant writer.
Yeah, you get grants.
But is there another correlated characteristic that is unrelated to like getting grants that could help you know that you're a good grant writer?
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's like a good characteristic, but I guess
it's just returns to experience.
Yeah, there's experience, but also if the idea of grant writing doesn't scare you away. For some people, I think it can be relatively unsettling, but good places, you know, not just public health schools, will generally have mentoring so that you're not just expected to sit on an island and eventually come up with a funded project. So, you know, for example, places might bring you in on projects where you play a competing role, and the idea is that you start gaining experience in the grant writing process by contributing to other grants, particularly senior PIs who have ongoing projects, and particularly if you can add your skills as a health economist to these other projects. One, it helps you get familiar with the grant writing process. It also helps the funding agencies get familiar with who you are so that you start building a rapport, you have a chance to build a relationship with these different funding agencies, particularly through the project officers, which I've learned is very, very important. And it's not always straightforward on how to go about doing this. One thing I would say, particularly young, if you're early on in this stage, is to, first thing is building a specific aims page, which will be a single one-page summary of what the research proposal would be. And then you find a project officer and then you share that with them and generally find a time to discuss the idea. One, to see if it falls in line with the funding announcement, which would be that particular opportunity.
Yep.
And one of the things that was helpful to me was I was actually inquiring about one funding opportunity. The project officer said it didn't fit with this one, but it actually aligns really well with another one that they also had written. So that's one of the other benefits of, you know, just getting clarity, and, you know, you could actually be led to a better opportunity by talking to a project officer.
So one more question too is, maybe can you share us or talk to us a little bit about how does that transition out to like a public health school coming out of the program that you did?
Yeah. So even though I came out of a health policy PhD, I feel I'm hardwired like an economist, like most of the other students coming out of econ PhDs. So that first year was a struggle in just not letting identification be a potential barrier, but also think about how can I do really good descriptive work,
which is super important. Yeah.
Right. And that's generally what is useful in public health settings, doing really good descriptive work, doing work that is continually policy relevant but well thought out. Theory doesn't have to be like overarching thing, but it should be informed by theory. So one of my struggles was like, I was trying very hard to write an econ paper when what I really needed to do was focus on writing good health policy papers. So I think one of the things that newly minted PhDs, particularly if they've come out of econ departments or any disciplinary department, is learn your department's expectations and try to focus on good work. Try not to let perfect be the enemy of the good.
Thanks so much for sharing all that information with us. I'm going to try to do a little bit of a summary of some of the stuff that you shared with our listeners today, and just butt in and let me know if I got something wrong or mischaracterized anything that you said. So I think broadly, there's just a variety of places where an economist or an economist-like students can find a job at afterwards. We mostly today focused on different types of academic departments that someone could be at. And we didn't even touch close to all of them, right? So we talked about schools of public health a lot. We talked about economics departments. I'm in a school of public and environmental affairs. Sebastian's at a place that focuses a lot on policy. There's ag schools as well. There's tons of different places. Each of them have their own idiosyncratic features. So for example, something we didn't discuss today is if you go work at an ag school, extension and outreach is a really important component. Whereas at public health, you know, we talked a lot about grants being an important component. So what's important to understand is just there are going to be different funding, tenure, research, and teaching expectations at all these different places. And figuring that out when you're on the market can be tough, but applying to them and then figuring it out sort of afterwards, like from your reduced choice set, is often the way to go. So, you know, we mentioned with the funding, at some schools there's hard money. At other schools, it's going to be more like soft money where you're expected to write and obtain grants. And at some places, the tenure expectations are going to be really different. And there's going to be different quality quantity trade-offs, right? Like a larger number of papers, maybe less focus on the ranking of the particular journals, but simply achieving some number. And there's also going to be different teaching expectations that come with those differential sources of funding, right? So at places where you're hard money, often you're getting that money because you're teaching lots of classes. And at places where you're soft money, a benefit of having these grants is going to be that you may teach one or zero courses a year. And something that I really like that you discussed there at the end, Joe, is like that sort of these outcomes, all of them that we talked about, are endogenous to the place that you end up, right? Like who you go to lunch with, the types of projects you get involved with, the mentorship you receive can make you a better grant writer or can help you learn to write these papers and sort of closer to the minimum publishable unit rather than in these like 90 page tomes that you might do in an economics department. So like if you're at an econ department versus a school of public health, assuming, I think this is the phrase you used, you're not on an island, you can figure out how to navigate these waters with a guide. And that's important to know, or at least important to seek out if you don't know and you start at one of these places.
Yes. And one of the things I will say is I benefited from a lot of great mentoring that's helped me become not just a better manuscript writer, but it also helped a lot with my grant writing as well. So that's always something, you know, when you can find good mentorship, definitely lean on them because ultimately they want you to do well.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for those insights. Every week we like to ask our guests for a recommendation of the week. This could be anything, a podcast, a command, an app, a song, a quote, or a book, a kitchen recipe, anything that improves your life in a small way. What is your recommendation of the week?
Okay. So I've seen people have CVs of their failures. So I actually have a playlist for my failures.
Oh.
So I actually have certain, so when I get paper rejections or I get rejected from.
I see you have a playlist of when that happens.
Yeah. So.
Oh. Is it public?
I've not made it public, but I'm willing to share. So.
Okay.
I always listen to Another One Bites the Dust from Queen when I get a paper rejection.
That's awesome.
And Get Back Up Again from Anna Kendrick. It's
Wait, I hope that you also have a playlist for successes.
If I had more successes, then
you gotta change it, right? You gotta like go to Vegas or Montreal or something every time you get an acceptance. Who needs a playlist?
Yeah. Well, I also have a I have a bourbon collection, so I'll go through my bourbon collection and figure out what I want to drink to go through, you know, to success.
The real life of Kentucky. Alex, what is your recommendation of the week?
So I'm going to copy Joe from earlier. Joe earlier talked about a voice actor that he liked a lot, and I listened to a lot of audiobooks and podcasts, and I had never thought to give this recommendation until you mentioned this, Joe. I love listening to Ray Porter talk. Ray Porter is a narrator and for Audible, and I will listen to objectively bad books that Ray Porter narrates just because it makes my drive more enjoyable. So an objectively good book that Ray Porter narrates is the Bobaverse, or I think that's like the name of the series. If you're a nerdy person into sci-fi and you like audiobooks, these are good books worth checking out.
This is about Boba Fett or no?
No. It's this guy named Bob that freezes himself and then wakes up like as a computer a couple hundred years later.
As one does.
He's also a machine. It's fantastic, right? If you're a huge nerd, if you're not a huge nerd, you may be uninterested.
Yeah.
The first thing that came across my mind too was Alternate Star Wars Universe 2.
I must have Bob mispronounced it. It's like We Are Bob, We Are Legion or something is the name of the book. I can look it up, but it's like the Bob-O-verse.
Gotcha. That's awesome. My recommendation of the week, maybe it's nerdy, maybe it's not, but as you get older, you'll notice that it's a lot harder to maintain or whatever, visit social media. And like I used to rely on Facebook to tell me my friends' birthdays, but to be honest, I don't get into Facebook anymore, or like if I do, it's like every thousands. And so I've been missing a couple of friends' birthdays. So what I've done is I created a list of most of the friends that I want to remind myself of their birthdays, and created a special calendar for it on my Google Calendar. And so now I have a calendar that reminds me of like, hey, this is somebody's birthday today. So say happy birthday to them. And so I don't have to rely on any social media and is there for life. So my recommendation of the week is create a calendar for your friends' birthdays. Awesome. Great. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today. If people want to find more about you and your work, where should they go?
Sure. I have a pretty vanilla Google site. So it is googlesites.com /sites. I can provide you the link for
it. Link in the show. Great. Well, that's all we have for you folks today. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review. Thank you for tuning in. Bye.
Thank you.